Welcome to another episode of The Last Post Radio Show. You're with Greg T. Ross, and it's my great joy to be bringing this to you live today from the Walter Eliza Hall Institute, hereby known as WEHI, and be speaking with my friend, Professor John Silk. John got a law degree in King's College London, degree in biochemistry at Churchill College in Cambridge, and specialises in a whole lot of things that we'll be speaking about now on The Last Post Radio Show. Hello, John. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Always good to catch up and discuss the latest things that are happening here at WEHI, and of course your personal studies. What would you call it?
Research into...
That's the word I was looking for.
Research into inflammation and cancer and that sort of intersection between the two.
So what, of course, it's a great interest in, without wanting to give away too much, my age group is prone to inflammation. So what can you tell us about that and other things that you're doing, John?
I think that inflammation is one of the key... We've become aware that inflammation is one of the key drivers of many cancers. And so that sort of chronic inflammation can help drive cancers. But what's really interesting for me is that one of the ways that we can treat cancers is by inhibiting inflammatory... One of the ways we can inhibit inflammation diseases is by inhibiting a driver of inflammation, which we call TNF. But that same molecule can be used with the right knowledge in the right situations to actually kill cancers. So this is where I was talking about that intersection. Got the same molecule driving, inflammatory molecule driving, but also you could potentially use it to kill cancers. TNF, that's the one.
So TNF, and so... I know you and I have spoken in the past about these things, and of course, there's always progress being made in these fields. But what sort of progress are you making, John? Are you happy with the way things are going?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just to, some of your listeners will undoubtedly be on TNF inhibitors, right? And they are some of the largest selling drugs in the world. They'll know, the patients will know them as infliximab or etanercept, and so basically, they're inhibiting TNF. The thing is, they're phenomenally expensive drugs. They are on the PBS, but you know they're very expensive to produce because they're antibodies. They don't work for all people, and in a few cases, they can actually drive more disease, more inflammation. So what we want to do is see, is can we make better inhibitors? And one of the things that we've really pushed in the last 10 years is this idea that TNF is actually causing cell death inappropriately, and it's actually the cell death part that if we could block with small molecules, with drugs, that might be more efficacious than these current drugs, which the sums of money are incredible. It's, you know, $30 billion in sales in these drugs, and that was a couple of years ago.
Wow, yes, I suppose if we look, this is from an outsider's point of view, of course, too, John, being part of the baby boomer generation and a huge number of people in this age demographic at least, there would be a lot of money to be made by these companies. I suppose your role is to make sure that what is produced has the most efficiency?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the key things is that TNF is an important... Inflammation is important, right, in normal situations. But when it's working, it generates inflammation that helps fight the disease, helps fight the problem, and then it shuts itself off. And the problem that people have in chronic inflammatory diseases is the process just doesn't turn off. And so we believe and test the ideas that if we can turn off the cell death part, then we can get it to kind of stop keeping the on switch, keeping the gas pedal on. But keep the good parts of TNF that could help fight infections, because it does do this other part. Mm.
It's an intriguing stuff too, John, when you describe it in that way, for layman's terms too, to understand. And I guess that is the secret, to make sure that it turns off when it should. What happens when it doesn't turn off?
Well, our model systems in the lab, when that doesn't turn off and the cell death doesn't turn off, then it just constantly drives more inflammation, more inflammation, more inflammation.
And how common is inflammation, out of control inflammation, in a certain age group?
I honestly don't know the percentages, but you know, it's, as I've indicated by the size of just the market of this TNF truck, it's pretty enormous.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I know a few people around my age group that have that. And prior to that, perfectly healthy. I'd played cricket with a couple of them.
Yeah.
And then to learn that two of my close friends have that inflammation. John, you've been in Australia for how long now?
Good question. 28 years. So my son was actually born in Switzerland, and then we moved here when he was like 2 months old. And we've been here ever since. And two more sons as well.
That's right. And we're so glad you moved here, mate. I tell you what, you got a law degree at King's College at London, and a degree in biochemistry, so that was at Churchill College. Were you set on in this direction of inflammation and linked to cancer from the beginning?
No, yeah, absolutely not. And as you can tell from my career, I wasn't even sure exactly what I wanted to do when I was 18. But I don't think there are many 18s really do know. And I was just had the privilege to be able to change directions. It caused me some angst at the time. You know, you're young and everyone, you're getting old and everyone's still young and they got their degrees. But I haven't ever regretted the change. I really was attracted to the area that I'm working on now by the research that was going on in Australia, and was cell death research, as I've already indicated. And at that time, I was told, you know, two of the best people in the world are here at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute.
Right.
And so I looked at both of them. And one, I had done my PhD in Switzerland, so that was another, you know.
Yeah. That's right.
And one of them was Swiss and one of them was Australian. And so I thought, oh, I don't need another Swiss boss. So I went with the Australian. So that was really the genesis of this interest. And then really looking at that cell death process. And then we made a really important observation that one of the routes to cell death was via this TNF molecule and how it was regulated. And then this triggered the whole inflammation cancer thing.
Wow. Your day. Now, of course, for the average Joe or Josephine out there listening, I've come here and I'm just amazed at the work being done. You have glass walls, which allows me, Joe Public, to have a look at the marvellous stuff that's been done. What does a normal day for you entail? I suppose there would be no normal day, but if just a general day, John.
I start work at 5:30 in the morning, and I like to do that because I've always been a morning person anyway. And and funnily enough, there are not many people who want to have meetings at 5:30 in the morning. So then I usually work to about 8 o'clock and go home, feed the dog, maybe sometimes have to walk the dog as well. And then I often try and get in a quick swim when the pool is no longer so busy, so 9 o'clock, and then come in at 10. And then that will be, again, like many people, learn to try and manage your data. You don't have too many meetings. So then it involves a lot of analyzing data, looking at data. I could say, unfortunately, not doing the experiments in the lab anymore, but maybe some people would say that was fortunate. But I think, you know, I do play to my strengths. I'm good at analyzing data and thinking about what's happening and, you know, a lot of experience. And really, I've always been the type of researcher that wants to read as much as I can and understand as much as I can about the subject. And then, unfortunately, by the afternoon, there's a lot of people that now want to have meetings with you. And then I usually leave about 6:30 in the evening. So I think I work quite hard. I think you have to in this life, you know.
Yes,
and but I also am very privileged that I have that sort of flexibility to adjust my day in the way that works best for me. And, you know, I do the same for the people in my lab. I say, whatever works for you, you know, you do that.
Yeah, that's fine. I suppose you noted there reading to find out more and more about the topic. And I guess just as an insight, how close are we to a resolution of this with the inflammation and cancer and the cell death and everything? Do you find this will be ongoing in your lifetime, or is that a stupid question?
It's definitely not a stupid question. And I think one thing that I can immediately say, it's a very exciting time to be doing this type of research, because some of the things that you that, you know, 20 years ago you would have liked to do, we now have the capabilities to do. It's still time consuming and expensive, but you know, I think your listeners will be so aware of the COVID vaccine, and you know, I mean, they may not remember, but you know, when COVID hit, people said, oh, we're not going to be able to develop a vaccine for this because, you know, we haven't been able to do it before. It's been impossible. This is a very difficult target. And then, you know, 2 years later, we're getting it into our arms and genuinely reducing the numbers of deaths and reducing the amount of disease, you know. So, and that, it did involve new technologies as well, this mRNA technology, which is very exciting. And there's going to be some set up here in the Parkville in Melbourne.
Oh, okay. That's interesting, John. And I guess if we go back to the COVID vaccines for just a moment, it was worrying times. I believe at one stage there were 700 people dying in Rome or Italy per night in hospitals. And, of course, nobody knew if it would ever get that bad in Australia. I guess we're in a different situation with the population and everything else. But the vaccine was effective in saving lives.
I mean, it's beyond any doubt. I mean, you can look in America, right, where you had the Democratic states and the Republican states. And so the Republican states didn't want to take the vaccine because of ideology, and the Democratic states did, and you can see the difference in the amount of deaths. Right. And you know, also let's not forget that no medicine is perfect, no vaccine is perfect. There may be, you know, one in a million person that has a thing, but look how it transformed our lives. I mean, I still, I'm not sure about you, but sometimes when I'm walking or in a huge crowd or having a meal in a restaurant, full restaurant, I'm thinking, we couldn't do this, you know, four years ago, right? Mm. And it's miraculous. And that has to be mostly driven by the success of the vaccine, in my opinion. Mm.
Well, a very learned opinion too for listeners out there. You're with Greg T. Ross on the Last Post radio show. We're speaking to Professor John Silkey from WEHI, Walter Eliza Hall Institute, and we'll be back in just a moment. Commonwealth Superannuation Corporation. As one of the first Australian super funds, we've been operating alongside the APS and ADF for over a century. Proudly supporting Australian government and Defence Force members, CSC is here to guide you on the surest path to your future. csc.gov.au.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post radio show on Captivate, Apple and Spotify.
Welcome back to the radio show, Greg Ross with Professor John Silkey. So, of course, we were speaking about the vaccine for COVID and the success in saving lives, and you see the same outcome with what you're doing.
Yeah, this mRNA technology that was used to develop a vaccine, it also has now the potential to treat other diseases. There's still delivery problems to get it to the right tissues and stuff, but again, these are problems that a lot of clever people are trying to overcome. Also, you know, we've in the last, you know, 30, 40 years learned an awful lot about medicinal chemistry. And so the ability to make new types of drugs has, you know, increased. And we have great places here in Australia trying to do that work. And one of the really interesting ones that I work on is a new type of drug, which is called a PROTAC. And we're not going to say what PROTAC stands for because it doesn't make any sense. But essentially what it does is, you know, I'm sure your listeners will be aware that it's often proteins that drive disease. You know, and it can be, if it's a genetic disease, that is a protein that's not made correctly and then drives a disease. But there are other ways that, you know, if that protein is overexpressed, like TNF, if it's overexpressed, it can actually drive disease. So what this new type of drug does is that it targets the protein for degradation. And so that has enabled us to target things that were never before felt possible to target. So, and one of the things that people say is that 90% of the proteins in the body were undruggable. We couldn't develop drugs. But now with this new technology, we can theoretically drug any one of them.
It must be exciting working here and being able to utilise what you have here at WEHI in the notion that this will be saving lives.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most impactful things that I ever did was, you know, let's be clear. I mean, every day I think about the problem of understanding these pathways to do things, and sometimes the intellectual problem can consume you. You're thinking about, you know, how do I solve this problem? But one of the most impactful things I ever did was go to the Royal Melbourne Hospital on a secondment, where just for a week was sitting in with a cancer surgeon and listening to him talk to these patients, and just seeing, you know, the professionalism. I mean, we're so fortunate here in Australia with our public health system. And I mean, I understand that some patients will not have the best experience, particularly at this difficult time. But when I sat there as an independent observer and watched what that surgeon did, how they presented information, and in some cases this is, you know, devastating information, and there may be the chances of living for a long time were not high, but how it was able to communicate that, but at the same time still give hope. It really just elevated my respect for the medical profession so much. And at the same time, as I've said, gave me a clear idea of why we are doing what we're doing. And on that note, I can't resist to mention this. And I think this has been a very positive development in medical research, is so-called consumers. Nobody likes the name consumer.
No, that's right.
But there are people, volunteers, and again, you know, how lucky are we that people in Australia just, you know, prepared to volunteer so much of their time. Volunteers that have had experience of a particular disease, whether it's cancer, whether it's an inflammatory disease or whatever, and then they sort of help, they participate in our research. I mean, some of our consumers, we meet, you know, once a month, and they provide so much insight into the disease, and they give us so much encouragement.
Yes.
You know, sometimes when you're stuck on trying to solve a problem for 2 years, and to hear a patient say, if you could do this, if you can do it, then it would be transformational. And to hear that helps keep the spirit, you know, keep the spirit strong.
Yeah, that's marvellous too, John, of course, and that personal, because as we know, every cancer, we should put it this way, every person's reaction to a certain cancer will be different.
Absolutely. And I mean, and each cancer is different. And even within the cancer, some of the cells are slightly different. That's another sort of learning that we're having. And that's one of the reasons perhaps why you can be successfully treated for a cancer. That cancer will go away, but there's one or two resistant cells in that cancer that then can come back. And that's one of the big problems that we have with current treatments, right? That we can get initial responses, and they can last for a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years, but it tends to always come back because you've got just those few cells that were a little bit different and were able to survive and then finally grow.
Yes, I have heard that, and know of a couple of friends that were cancer-free, only for it to come back. And so the odds, I suppose that's what we're aiming to get rid of too, that reoccurrence.
Yeah. And again, talking about new, this is not my particular area of research, but it, you know, saying that it is an exciting time. One of the exciting things is to be able to recruit the immune system to fight the cancer.
Wow.
And one of those therapies which is being developed is called a CAR T cell. They're also making lorry T cells and truck T cells. So you see, the scientists have a lively sense of fun there. But these CAR T cells are manufactured T cells from the patient that can recognize the tumor, and there've been some, you know, interesting successes there. The problem is, each one costs about $500,000 to kind of a treatment. Jeez. And so this is, you know, again another area where you can see that. I always like to think of it as F1 car racing, right? That, you know, you're pushing the limits to develop something, but then the things that you learn will eventually come down into our, you know, cars that we use day to day, and they will increase the safety and the price will go down.
That's very, very good analogy, very good comparison. And you heard that, if there's a millionaire listening out there, just give some money to WeHi and let's get rid of all these cancers and everything too, John. What else is happening at WeHi that's worth mentioning?
One of the interesting stories that was just in the news, in The Age, and I'm sure in the Sydney Morning Herald and stuff, and also in the New York Times, was this wonderful, again, Australian story about a wonderful human being called James Harrison. And so when he was 13, he had a horrible accident and had massive blood transfusion, and he was given rhesus D positive blood. And so generated antibodies to that blood. You know, again, I'm pretty sure that some of your audience will have heard of this, because if a woman is rhesus D negative and has a baby that is rhesus D positive, she will start to develop antibodies to her embryo, to her baby. And usually in the second and third pregnancies, this is the babies don't survive. But the way that they can be treated is with this blood from a person, a man like James Harrison, to purify the important antibodies and then treat the lady, the pregnant woman, with those antibodies. And James Harrison made over 1,100 blood donations and possibly saved 2.5 million babies. And he's Australian,
yeah.
They call him the man with the golden arm, which is a lovely thing. And what's really happening here at the WeHi is, while this is an effective treatment and is used throughout the Western world, it's not the best medicine. You know, purifying blood products is not the future of medicine that we want to see.
No, they could be infected with
well, yeah, and you know, I won't. Yeah, but nobody needs to. They can use their imaginations.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not the best way to make a medicine. So there's a great clinician scientist here in the WeHi called Ian Weeks, who That's came right. up with the idea That's of right. how yeah. can we create these antibodies in a bacteria. How can we create them recombinantly, and then they'll be perfect and clean and not touched, never seen human blood, but they will be able to do the job. And so he's really pushed along.
Ian Wick has done a lot of good work, hasn't
he? Yeah, and he's a rheumatologist, so he and I share a big interest in TNF. And it was, as I said, unfortunately, James Harrison just passed away in the last week, which is why he made the news. But the story never goes old. And it's a beautiful Australian story, because it was an Australian doctor, researcher, I think his name was John Gorman, from Bendigo in the 50s, who actually came up with this idea of using these antibodies from people that were generating antibodies.
Wow, exciting news. And maybe people would be able to access that through The Age or the New York Times?
Absolutely. It was just there in the last week. So I think it may even say Man with the Golden Arm.
Just Google Man with the Golden Arm and up will come the story of that.
He definitely has a Wikipedia page, which is a nice start.
And what's his name again?
James Harrison.
Well, we salute to James and Absolutely. Valet too, and bless him for all his work. Now, on a more personal level here, happy birthday for yesterday.
Happy birthday, John.
Thank you very much.
The reason I say that, everyone, is because coming to WeHi, one of the best things that's ever happened to me, I was given this beautiful chocolate cake, which was left over from John's birthday celebrations. I asked John who made it. He told me it was his wife, and boy, oh boy.
Contact my wife for the recipe. She's very, very proud of it. It's a moist chocolate cake.
We might give your wife a page in the next edition.
That's it.
I'm sure she won't appreciate it.
Well, that was bloody lovely. I'll have to go and do a bit of jogging now. Thanks so much for that. Professor John Silkey from the Walter Eliza Hall Institute, talking about inflammation, cancer, biology and cell death, etc., along with a lot of other things that was great learning. We might come back at some stage in the near future and catch up with John again to get an update on things, because it's always worth coming here to get a bit of good coffee and chocolate cake. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure and such a joy to be able to tell people about what we do. And, you know, I'm always relish the opportunity to as you said, the labs have got glass things. We want the public to come and see the good things that we're doing, and the WEHI does run programs like that. And if you happen to come by and knock on my door.
Fantastic, John. We will do, and we encourage everyone to do that, to see the amazing work that's being done at the Walter Eliza Hall Institute, a partner with The Last Post now for many years, and we hope that will continue. Yeah.